Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Mark Peacher, Deloitte Professor of Accountancy, University of Illinois in Champaign, and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chat series is made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand name under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The virtual museum and archive celebrates its 10th anniversary this year and has welcomed more than 1 million visitors. Both the museum and the society are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no public funding. The society is grateful for the sustained and generous support of Deloitte LLP in making the Deloitte Fireside Chats possible. Since its debut in 2009, the Deloitte Fireside Chats have become the authoritative series on current issues in financial regulation of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. Past broadcasts, all available in the Deloitte Fireside Chat section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive, have addressed such topics as the role of professional judgment, principles versus rules-based accounting, responsibility for preventing and detecting financial reporting fraud, and the role of the SEC in accounting standard setting. I would encourage those listening to today's program to access the previous chats in both audio MP3 and edited transcript formats at their convenience after the broadcast. They are well worth your attention. Today, we will examine how the profession, both attorneys and accountants and auditors, look at the Sarbanes-Oxley Act since its enactment a decade ago. Joining with me today are Alan Beller of Cleary Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton LLP, and a former director of the SEC Division of Corporate Finance. Mr. Beller is also a trustee of the SEC Historical Society, and Joseph Uguzoglu of Deloitte LLP, and a former senior advisor and professional accounting fellow in the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant. Welcome. Before we begin, I would like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Deloitte LLP or the SEC Historical Society. The Society selected me to moderate the program. I have worked with the presenters to determine the topics and questions that will guide the content of our discussion. One of the hallmarks of the Deloitte Fireside Chats is that it is an interactive series and that visitors to the Virtual Museum and Archive are encouraged to submit questions for the chats. We have received a number of questions for today's discussion, and I'll be using some of them during the broadcast. So, let me begin by turning to Alan, though I'm sure afterwards Joe will want to add his perspective. In the U.S., the Sarbanes-Oxley Act is often portrayed as the most significant regulatory intervention in market for the financial statement auditing of publicly held clients since the 1933 and 34 Securities Acts. Yet it hit me actually this semester when teaching an audit course at Illinois that my students were 10 or 11 and 12-year-olds when this event occurred. They didn't really experience this watershed event. They have been told that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act emerged after a perfect storm of corporate fraud and malfeasance, as well as alleged audit failures surrounding entities such as Enron and WorldCom, together with some ardent political motivations and perspectives. But Alan, can you take us to the real backstory?
Well, I don't know if it's the real backstory, but it's one person's recollection of the backstory. The timeline is important. Enron filed for bankruptcy in December of 2001. And after a break for the holidays, by mid-January of 2002, we were in a political, regulatory, press, and investor frenzy. This was, among other things, I think the beginning of the SEC being on page one of the Wall Street Journal nearly every day as opposed to page C-15, something that continues to this day for better or for worse. As Mark said, this was thought of as a financial reporting and an auditing crisis. Indeed, it was particularly a crisis, including a political crisis, for the major auditing firms. In mid-January, the auditing firms had been regulated by the AICPA in a form of self-regulation up until this time. And the then chairman of the SEC, Harvey Pitt, and the then chief accountant announced in mid-January, I think it was my third day at work, we had a little press conference at which we announced the end of self-regulation of the auditing profession under the auspices of the AICPA and that it would be replaced by something else. We'll get to that in a minute. Also in terms of the auditing profession, we had hard on the heels of this the demise of Arthur Andersen, which was one of the big five accounting firms at the time. They were indicted on March 14th of 2002. They were actually indicted for obstruction of justice. But the clamor and the investigation also included the alleged blown audit of Enron. On March 18th, only 4 days after that, the commission adopted emergency final rules for issuers that were audited by Andersen, which in effect gave issuers the ability to get their 10-Ks, which were due generally on March 31 for 30 for calendar companies, either audited by Andersen or someone else. Corp Fin had actually been working on those rules for several weeks, and we had been living in fear that the indictment was going to come down not on March 18th, because March 18th was close enough to the end of the preparation period for 10-Ks that it had relatively little impact. But if it had come down on February 18th, we would have had some really serious issues, and that's what the rules were intended to deal with. They were done entirely in secret by a small group of people in Corp Fin with the knowledge, obviously, of the five commissioners, or I guess there were, three commissioners at that time. The problem being that if there was a leak that Corp Fin was working or that the commission was working on those rules prior to the announcement of the indictment, it would have been a prediction that would have the demise would have come faster. The other thing that's important about this time in the run-up to Sarbanes-Oxley was we were in 2002 is a midterm election year, and there was enormous concern at the White House and among Republicans that this crisis was going to damage their chances in November. And there was corresponding hope of being able to take advantage of that by the Democrats. President Bush called on the president's working group, which had been established in 1987 after the market drop, to come up with an appropriate solution to Enron. And the president's working group was composed of the Secretary of the Treasury, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, the chair of the SEC, and the chair of the CFTC. And the PWG consulted on what became the president's 10-point plan, which was announced on March 7th of 2002. And indeed, that plan had a very significant amount of SEC input into it, including principally from, again, Chairman Pitt. There were in that 10-point plan, and this is, I think, the interesting point, a number of points that were included in the Sarbanes-Oxley: CEO-CFO certification, a new regulatory board for auditors that ultimately became the PCAOB, faster reporting of insider trading, beefed up current reporting on 8K, officer and director bars, increased penalties, disgorgement for of compensation, and the like. the president's plan was this was a program that could be implemented by his administration and the SEC without legislation. The Democratic reaction was, we need legislation. This is inadequate. Starting in February, March, and into April, there were a number of legislative proposals, which were, in fact, notwithstanding the president's proposal, were pretty bipartisan. There were bills reported out of both the House and Senate committees, Senate Banking, House Financial Services. They were basically a large part of what became SOX. And then they languished, reported out by the committees in April or thereabouts, and it was pretty clear at that point that the Congress was not going to do anything more. The SEC then began a rulemaking effort to implement the president's 10-point plan where SEC action was appropriate. And there are rules proposals that you can go read on the SEC's website for the establishment of what became under SOX, the PCAOB, for CEO-CFO certification, for requiring companies to report insider trades within 2 days. We couldn't ask the insiders themselves to report because the 34 Act had the time limits in Section 16. But there was nothing that said that we couldn't make the companies report on Form 8K, and so that's what we proposed. And that was all moving along as we reached late June. And then on June 25th, WorldCom announced a $4 billion write-down and an accounting fraud. The actual number ended up being $12 billion, but no one's counting it when you reach those levels. And that started the furor all over again, and it was clear within, I would say, 24 hours after the WorldCom announcement that there was going to be legislation. It took till mid-July or so, July 20th or so, for both houses of Congress to act. The Senate passed what became Sarbanes-Oxley by 99-0, as I recall. The House passed Sarbanes-Oxley by 2 million to 3, as I recall, and the president signed it on July 31st, 2002. And that is that's the history of how you got there.
Oh, that's fascinating. And this particular, the part about how the inertia had slowed and then it built very rapidly after WorldCom. I don't know, Joe, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the specifics about SOX? Some of the big sections with respect to corporate governance or respect to the auditing profession.
Be happy to. I do hope that everyone realizes what a privilege it is to be listening to Alan give really a kind of behind-the-scenes, firsthand account of how this all played out in the tense moments of early 2002. Just fascinating. Whenever one engages in a discussion around Sarbanes-Oxley, it's really important to look to not just the list of technical rules that were enacted, and we'll talk about a few of those, and many were very impactful, but also the cultural effects that some of those new requirements brought about. On the rulemaking side, in the aftermath of Sarbanes-Oxley, we obviously saw the imposition of an audit requirement over internal controls. No longer was it good enough for the auditor simply to attest to the reasonableness of the numbers, but the auditor had to actually go in and audit the company's system of internal control. And so in the event the company kind of got the numbers right by accident or only after the auditor came in and fixed everything, that wasn't good enough. The company itself had to have the systems and processes in place to get the numbers right. We saw very significant scope of services restrictions placed upon outside audit firms with respect to services that could be provided to their audit clients and a ban on those services that were deemed to be independence impairing. Perhaps most significantly was the creation of the Independent Audit Committee of the Board. It's interesting that the role that Sarbanes-Oxley gives to the Independent Audit Committee is somewhat unique in the corporate governance landscape. Most roles that boards play are of an oversight nature. Management has the primary responsibility and the board provides an oversight function. if you actually read the statute, it's literally just one sentence, but it's very powerful, and it states that in not so many words, the audit committee is directly responsible for the appointment, oversight, and compensation of the independent auditor. It is a tremendous responsibility and one that audit committees take very, very seriously. And it's brought about a tightening of the relationship between the auditor and the audit committee and made very clear that the auditor's client is not the management of the company under audit. The auditor's client is the investing public that is relying upon those financial statements, and the investing public is represented in the boardroom by the independent auditor. Alan referenced kind of bringing to an end the era of self-regulation in the profession. These are a few of the detailed rules. Then you go into kind of what were the cultural effects, and perhaps the best illustration is the requirement that management certify the financial statements under the penalty of criminal liability. It's more than just a signature. It's the cultural effect of a level of accountability that is associated with a chief executive officer or a chief financial officer putting their name on the financial statements and asserting that these are right. Not that, you know, I didn't realize what my accountants were doing or these are all very complicated rules and it wasn't brought to my attention, but that the buck stops here. And one might argue that even though that might be the least costly of the set of regulations to implement, that it was actually the most impactful because of the level of accountability that came along with it.
Very interesting. Joe, I want to stay with you for a moment and probe some particular provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. There have been several scholars, dozens of commentators, who have observed that in requiring an audit of internal controls over financial reporting, that SOX created by fiat some market that did not exist on its own. And their point seems to be that, look, if shareholders wanted public companies' internal controls over financial reporting to be audited, then the law of supply and demand already would have made that happen. So by mandating this new service, one could argue, their story goes, that regulators may have reallocated investors' capital away from what they saw as its most productive use. But then there's another side. The other side is you have almost as many scholars and commentators, it would seem, that say that SOX did not go far enough. They claim that even post-SOX, regular investors do not have sufficient voice in corporate governance. So with the mixed opinions that we see, how should students, practitioners, regulators, and others think about the limits of markets, free markets, for these kinds of services, and of regulation when it comes to financial reporting?
It's important to take a step back and, you know, understand the broader corporate governance infrastructure, because there is a very significant difference between who is paying for the independent audit, that being the company under audit, as opposed to who is the primary beneficiary and user of the independent audit, that being the investing public. The difficulty that we have is that at many companies, you may literally have thousands of investors who own as few as a couple of shares each. And you can't consult with each of them. And so we have a regulatory system of investor protection where, as a precondition to accessing the public markets, we've decided upon a certain minimum standard that those companies that want to enjoy the benefit of accessing the public markets need to meet. And one can always debate exactly where that line is and what that minimum standard ought to represent. Since the Securities Acts of 33 and 34, we've required the independent audit of the financial statements. And obviously, a decade ago, policymakers made the judgment that that wasn't enough, and that an audit of internal control ought to itself also be required. One can endlessly debate, and if you actually put this to a vote of the shareholders, would they choose to expend their resources by virtue of having the company they owned expend corporate dollars on the audit of internal controls? And it's an impossible question to answer because we haven't put it to a vote. But there is certainly some amount of academic research out there that would indicate there is a lower cost of capital associated with those companies that do undergo an internal control audit, which provides at least some level of evidence as to the value that investors do place on the service.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of the studies that come to my mind are companies that do not have material weaknesses written up in those opinions. They're the ones who enjoy the lower cost of capital. Alan, did you have any other perspectives on that particular issue?
My thought on this 404, the internal control provisions, were clearly the most controversial part of Sarbanes-Oxley, I think. And I've often said that we had 22 sets of rules that we had to implement under SOX on the corporate side, and my view has always been we had about 21 pretty close to bullseyes and one rim shot. And 404 was the rim shot. I think the notion that the market should decide by itself kind of proves too much, and Joe made the point. I haven't heard for years somebody say that audited financial statements should be optional because investors can ask for them if they want them. There's too big an agency problem in that kind of a theory, it seems to me. But I do think the internal control provisions, there's kind of a conceptual issue, there's a design issue, and there's an execution issue. I think the conceptual issue was probably pretty close to right. I think the design issue, the original set of rules, AS2, as promulgated by the PCAOB, and the SEC approved them, combined with the severe risk aversion at the time among both companies and auditors, led to a suboptimal design of internal control audits. They were too expensive. They were too check-the-boxy. They were not – I think you're going to get to the opposite point later on in this conversation, but the fact is they were not integrated enough with the audit to be as useful as they could be. And that's been, I think, largely correct. The design part of that, I think, has been largely corrected. And then there's an execution part. And I think that's still a work in progress. You know, it's odd to say we've been at something for only 8 years. But the fact of the matter is we've been at this for only 8 years. I think we'll be better at it, or both companies and auditors will be better at it in 8 more years. And that's kind of the way I think about it. I don't have a huge problem with what the Jobs Act did in cutting back the audit of internal controls for smaller companies. I think there is an issue of cost effectiveness. I think smaller companies, you know, the studies show that there are more instances of bad financial reporting at small companies than at large companies. The large companies' incidences are more expensive. But I think the control issues are less complicated. There are small, complicated companies. There are large, simple companies. But as a rule of thumb, smaller companies tend to be simpler than larger companies. And you can justify the change the Jobs Act made on that rule of thumb, I think.
Okay. Yeah, Joe.
It is interesting. You know, Alan, you mentioned that 21 of the 22 rules were relatively obvious, and it's the 22nd that's
generated. I didn't
generated
say they were obvious. I said they were well done.
It's the 22nd that's generated the controversy. And I think as a result, mistakenly, many in the kind of popular conversation refer to this one very narrow sliver of Sarbanes-Oxley interchangeably with Sarbanes-Oxley in its totality. This one requirement, Section 404B, is but a tiny sliver of Sarbanes-Oxley. And yet when folks speak of Sarbanes-Oxley, they often essentially mean 404B and lose sight of the broader framework, much of which is far less controversial and on balance, you know, certainly restored a level of credibility to corporate financial reporting.
Well, I know that many times students, when they look for this must be a huge section about internal control audits, they sometimes will miss it because it's really, like you say, a small paragraph. But let me be a little a bit of a devil's advocate here, perhaps. And, you know, one of the things that I've observed through the years is a number of commentators identifying several downsides of SOX, and maybe they're really talking about the downsides of 404. But the things that they'll tee up are issues such as a myopic focus on narrowly defined internal controls over financial reporting instead of business process controls. Or some studies have suggested that there was a depression in market prices. Equity security pricing dropped after the passage of this act. That's a tough thing to pin on the act, perhaps. Decreased public ownership in other studies, and of course there are the new direct costs. And then one indirect cost we sometimes would hear about, and I know that you've heard about as well, is firms that choose to remain public instead of listing their shares in a U.S.-based exchange will take their listing to an alternative exchange such as in London. So, Alan, let me go with you first on this one. First, is there 10 years later, is there any continued legitimacy to these costs, and have they been substantial?
Well, the initial costs were clearly very substantial, but I think they can be attributed to a significant extent to the design issues and the initial execution issues that I referred to earlier. As Joe said, you know, let's repeal Sarbanes-Oxley, by which I think people generally mean let's repeal 404. I think the issue with the U.S. Public markets, if there is one, and the statistics suggest that there may be one, goes well beyond Sarbanes-Oxley and goes well beyond 404, and is actually more a function of the fact that there are larger global capital markets, and the U.S. market is a smaller portion of the whole pie. I think when I started practicing, it was probably 50%+. It's now around 30, and I think that's as much to explain. That goes as far to explain to explain what's going on than a focus on 404. I am sure there are companies that don't go public because they don't want to go through 404. But I think there are probably more companies that don't go public because, in effect, the totality of the burdens of being a public company in this country are outweigh the advantages of access to the market.
This issue of weighing the costs and benefits of regulation, and in particular financial regulation, continues to be on the front burner, and it's even entered the political dialogue. What is important to keep in perspective, though, is where we were starting from and the level of fear that had gripped the markets at that time. There was a wholesale lack of confidence in the accuracy of reported financial information, and I'm not sure how you put a price tag on restoring that credibility. It's almost a precondition for having a functioning market. Specifically with respect to this issue around the internal control costs, a good chunk of the noise does tend to come from those companies that are on the smaller end of the spectrum. I think it is a fair observation that the costs are disproportionate. You're never going to achieve a phenomenon where, as a percentage of revenue, the very largest companies are spending the same dollars as the very smallest companies. There is an economy of scale associated with being large, but there have certainly been substantial efforts to increase the scalability relative to the size of the company, and the PCAOB in its issuance of AS5 was attempting to do exactly that. And again, earlier this year, we had the policymakers respond with the issuance of the Jobs Act to try to provide an onboarding mechanism to at least mitigate to the extent to which that disproportionality falls upon those smaller companies. With respect to this issue of the competitiveness of the U.S. capital markets and, you know, do we see companies fleeing, I wholeheartedly agree with you, Alan, that what we're seeing in large part is an evening of the playing field and the development in other geographies of a viable alternative. Not necessarily that the U.S. itself is to blame, but naturally if there are other viable alternatives, some will go there. And in fact, if you look at the regulatory regimes around the globe, they tend to be moving directionally towards Sarbanes-Oxley, not against it. And in fact, many of the proposed auditing and corporate governance reforms that are being debated in Europe right now mimic aspects that we've been living with for a decade. And so I don't think the answer is to kind of strive for the lowest common denominator in the interests of kind of stealing listings away from other jurisdictions that have kind of raised their competitiveness.
All right. Well, I want to kick it back to you for the flip side here a little bit. We've gone through the process of listing some of the alleged and perhaps real downsides of SOX, but what about the flip side? You took us a little bit through the thought experiment of what if tomorrow we woke up and suddenly, not maybe SOX in its entirety, but the 404 provisions were to go away. Would firms continue to get this audit done on internal controls over financial reporting? And if so, there must be some benefits. And let me work a little bit of a question that some professionals from Deloitte have advanced to us today along these lines, because they're curious about some of the potential benefits of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. In particular, the question is, how did, and this could kick back to Joe too, but how did audit committee members initially react to the initial responsibility and authority that they had under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act? Have they enhanced the communication that they have with members of the independent audit team, the engagement partner in particular? Let's tee those questions up in addition to any other benefits. Now, some of these benefits that have come from Sarbanes-Oxley may have been planned and foreseen, but others of these benefits may have been rather almost unintended benefits. We hear of unintended consequences all the time. So I wondered if, Alan, if you had any perspectives along those lines.
Yes, I do. To start with your first question, I think if the audit provisions were repealed, the internal control audit provisions were repealed tomorrow, I think it's likely that, frankly, most companies would not get a piece of paper from their audit firms that say, we've audited internal controls, dot, dot, dot. But I do think that certainly most larger companies would go through essentially the same management exercise as they do today. I mean, I think that's now become ingrained in the way large companies prepare their financial statements and rely on controls and systems to get them right, or to increase the possibility or the likelihood that they'd be right. So I actually think that would change relatively little, at least on the large side of the spectrum. And I think audit firms – this is really more Joe's point than mine. I'd be curious to know what he thinks. I think audit firms would probably do largely the same work they do now, even though they wouldn't necessarily deliver that piece of paper at the end, because I think certainly from my experience as a member of an audit committee, I think audit firms rely on that work to inform their financial statement audit. You know, they always did that. They did that pre-404, but I think it's become a larger part of the exercise. So would it change? Yes. Would it change all that much? I actually think not. And it's kind of interesting. If you sit on audit committees or advise audit committees, and Joe, you've seen this too, I think the number of controls or the number of controls that are now included in the key controls that have to be checked as a matter of the 404 work program, I think they've gone down by a very significant percentage in the 8 years since these kinds of audits started. I don't want to quite say they've gone down by half, but I think probably at some companies they have gone down by half, and in others they've gone down by a very large amount. Your other question, which is sort of what were the advantages? I mean, I really do think largely for the reasons Joe mentioned earlier, there were this notion of having audit committees more responsible for monitoring the work of the independent auditor was an absolutely – it was an intended consequence of the Act. That was – if the Act was trying to do one thing, that's what it was trying to do. And that's what the reason for the independent audit committee provisions. I think the cultural change that accompanied that and the closeness and the closeness of communication between audit committees and outside auditors, especially the engagement partner at well-functioning audit committees, I think may be a bonus unintended consequence of that. I mean, I think at a well-functioning audit committee, the way that the auditors and the audit committee the PCAOB may not want to hear this, work together in a practical sense is, I think, very important. That's also a change. When you started in 2004, Joe, you remember, there was a whole furor about could the independent auditor look at drafts of financial statements? Or was that getting involved in the preparation and therefore impugning independence? I think we've gotten past that kind of overly technical, overly process-oriented way of behaving. And I think audit committees and auditors now have a very healthy relationship where they're both doing their jobs.
So, Joe, do you want to add to some of those perspectives?
Well, I might pick up where you left off, Alan. The pendulum always swings too far, and then folks figure out the right balance. And there were a few examples in the immediate aftermath of Sarbanes-Oxley. One of them was exactly, as Alan just mentioned, in an effort to demonstrate that the auditor is performing an independent attestation function and that the company itself is responsible for getting the numbers right, so you don't have the auditors closing the books and then auditing their own work. There was at times a tendency to say, well, I can't advise the company on how to actually get the numbers right. I have to then come along and audit it. And you saw this kind of manifest itself in extremes such as I can't look at a draft white paper. You need to kind of finalize the answer before I can tell you if you got it right. Or I can't look at a draft of the financial statements. You know, you show me what you think that ought to look like, and then I'll let you know if they're wrong. And the PCAOB and the SEC themselves came out in the 2004-05 timeframe and very forcefully said that kind of behavior is not conducive to high-quality financial reporting. And so let's define what it means to be working together. Working together doesn't mean management and the auditor collaborating to achieve joint objectives, but what it does mean is that both collectively promoting an atmosphere of high-quality reporting. And so to the extent that the auditor can share with the company under audit, suggestions as to how to improve the quality of its accounting, how to improve the quality of its disclosure, recommendations as to internal controls that they may have seen elsewhere that would be beneficial for the company to adopt, that type of behavior is a good thing. I think we also saw some of that kind of pendulum swinging too far in the context of the number of controls that were identified, 7,000 key controls. Anytime you have 7,000 of something, it's questionable as to whether all of them are really key. And a ratcheting back and a focus on what's truly important, with AS5 placing a very clear emphasis on the auditor searching for those types of things that could go wrong that would actually cause a material misstatement of the company's financial statements. The operative word being material, not any problem with the company's financial statements. And we also saw audit committees evolve. At first, this was also overwhelming, the number of new requirements that were imposed upon the committee, and that tends to bring with it checklist might be too harsh of a word, but a procedural mentality of making sure I've covered all of the things I'm supposed to do. And if you spend the whole meeting going through a checklist, you don't leave time for the substance of really delving into the few issues that are important. And I think we've reached a point now where we have a much better balance of making sure that we don't get lost in the minutiae and that, in fact, the few critical, most important issues do, in fact, rise to the top. In terms of unintended benefits, I would say that, you know, this might not be the wholesale view across corporate America, but you do more and more hear executive-level folks from companies talking about the benefits that they've seen from the 404B internal control process extend beyond just, I know I have good financial controls, but that there's actually an operational benefit to running a tight ship and to having a certain level of discipline in place to make sure that appropriately high standards are being consistently complied with. And that fosters an overall higher level of quality of business conduct.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a couple of things to that. On Joe's last point, you talk about business process controls. I actually think well-functioning, well-controlled companies think about SOX and non-SOX controls together. And yes, the audit extends only to the SOX controls, but when you're on an audit committee and you're listening to the internal audit, the head of internal audit report every quarter, they're combined. It's not, oh, we're not looking at the business process controls. So I think that is, in fact, an unintended benefit, and that is happening. The other thing I'd say is we've talked about internal controls. There's another set of controls out there which is not directly tied to the audit function, but we've been talking about CEO-CFO certification. I don't think you think about CEO-CFO certification in a vacuum. You think about it in conjunction with the other requirement that those rules produce, which is a company has to have disclosure controls and procedures. And the reason that's important is the CEO-CFO certification says, to my knowledge, these are all correct. You know, these are materially correct, materially complete. The theory of disclosure controls is the company has a system to get in front of the CEO and the CFO all the information he or she needs in order to make that judgment. And so the disclosure controls and procedures support the overall certification system. The CEO can't just say, well, nobody told me. Because if the disclosure controls and procedures are working the way they're supposed to, if that something he or she wasn't told was really important, then it should have gotten up to their attention. And if you go back and look at the theory behind disclosure controls and procedures, I think that's, in fact, another unintended consequence and benefit of the statute. You really do have a much better disclosure culture at well-functioning companies than you had. And what was almost – I don't want to say it was hit or miss, because that's over-exaggerating on the other side. But there was not a necessarily well-thought-out, well-constructed system of getting information to where it should be for disclosure purposes.
And I think before Sarbanes-Oxley, there was a different mindset as to what kind of accounting and financial disclosure were about. And some would have viewed them as being a compliance exercise, and at the extreme, how do I minimally comply, versus a culture of transparency that, no, this isn't just an exercise in making sure I meet some minimum government regulations. This is a communication with shareholders, and that I ought to go into it not with a checklist of I complied with Rule 1 and Rule 2 and Rule 3, but have I really faithfully portrayed the financial performance of my company to my constituent, the owners?
All right. So looking at Sarbanes-Oxley as a portfolio, I think was one of the big points that I heard you guys both make just now. Of course, the organization created by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. And this is a question that actually comes to us today from Anthony Beccaro. And he notes that officially the mission of the PCAOB is to oversee the audit of public companies in order to protect the interest of investors and to promote the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports. But unofficially, the world seems to think the mission is to improve audit quality. So one of the ironies we have here is that for a long time, firms such as your organization at Deloitte have been trying to make the case that we're improving or maintaining audit quality. But now we have the PCAOB claiming that audits have improved as a result of their oversight and inspection processes. Do you feel that the evidence that they provide points that direction?
There is no question in my mind that the overall quality of audits throughout corporate America is substantially improved if you compare today to 10 years ago. As an insider who's out there doing these audits myself and part of a firm that does a fair percentage of the overall audits, there is no question that assertion is accurate. It is exceptionally difficult to come up with metrics to prove it. Folks better than I have tried. One would probably have to start with defining audit quality, and even that term is subject to a diverse set of perspectives. What does audit quality mean? And then once you can agree on a definition, if you can, then you can set about trying to come up with quantitative metrics to demonstrate. People talk about input type metrics. How long does it take? What's the expertise of the people doing it? More folks care about output metrics. How do I actually know that the end product was good? And by that measure, there are several things that people might look at, none of which is individually determinative. I think it's well documented that restatements are down tremendously in the 10 years since Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted. Now, how much of that credit goes to some of the regimes that are applicable to companies and therefore companies producing better information versus how much of that is really attributable to the incremental rigor of the audit, we could debate. But what the investor at the end of the day cares about is, were the numbers right? They're less concerned with, you know, who exactly got them right. And so by that measure, the number of circumstances where a financial statement was originally issued and later had to be amended because it was materially misstated is drastically down, unquestionably a positive. Securities litigation is way, way down in the area of alleged misstatements in financial statements. Then you can get into some of the direct measures of auditor performance, things like inspection results. We certainly across the profession have seen increases in inspection findings recently. There's no question that the level of rigor in the inspection process is bringing things to firms' attention that then warrants very, very significant efforts to remediate those issues, which in turn drives incrementally higher levels of auditor performance. So all of these things converging, I do think, lend support to that notion that audit quality is in fact getting substantially better and continuing to get better.
I think that's right. I think there's no question but that the quality of audits is up. The quality of care, the focus on the things that are potentially most troublesome, I think both have gone up. As Joe says, it's hard to measure it, but I'm morally certain it's correct based on watching the work of auditors and audit committees on a on a daily basis, which is what I basically do. The other interesting thing about the quote you just read is there's over the last couple of years in particular, there's been the PCAOB has focused a lot and has put out a couple of concept releases on this notion of serving investors better means more transparency to investors. I mean, that's a mantra that we've often heard. And excuse me, the PCAOB has picked it up. I think that understates the importance of what we've been talking about. I actually think investors are best served by really high quality performance by outside auditors. and oversight of that and communication about that with audit committees. I think that's the key to quality audits, making sure the audit committee really understands what the auditor is doing and not doing. And I'm not persuaded that longer audit reports – I mean, there's some things I'd like to see in audit reports you don't currently see, but I'm not persuaded that longer audit reports is the key to better audit quality. I think the key to better audit quality is to continue to refine the model we are currently working on, which is let's make sure the audit committees and the auditors are doing their jobs as well as they can.
Let me tee up something that may really have much to do with an expectations gap more than anything else. But one of the things that I have to explain to the students and other close associates would be they ask something like this. Why, if SOX was so great, did it do nothing to prevent the financial crisis? And is it possible that this type of audit work may have distracted auditors from maybe communicating one with another and picking up more forcefully on an erosion in the quality of financial reporting of banks and others involved in what we now think of almost everywhere as subprime and prime mortgage-backed securities? So can you, Joe, can you help us think a little bit about the relation, if any, between legislation like Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the horrific financial crisis from which we're still trying to recover?
The financial crisis is a very different phenomenon from what we experienced a decade ago leading up to the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley. A decade ago, what we had was essentially a financial reporting crisis. In many cases, it's outright fraud, making up numbers and reporting them to investors. The financial crisis largely was not about problems with accounting. There are very few cases where financial statements, even now in hindsight, were determined to have been materially misstated at the time. Certainly failures in risk management, but not in accounting. As a matter of fact, some have actually accused the auditors of having been too tough, that when the financial crisis hit, things were obviously headed downhill and the auditors were taking a very hard line and requiring many of these securities that were held by financial institutions to be marked down to fair value, which some characterized as kind of unrealistically low fire sale prices, alleging that this was making the crisis worse because of a pro-cyclicality where in the face of bad news, these markdowns were creating yet more bad news that was feeding off of itself. And so you almost have this phenomenon where some would say, well, where were the auditors? Yeah, the watchdog didn't bark. And some are saying that the watchdog was actually too tough. And I think that the fact that this wasn't so much a crisis in accounting is reflective of what ultimately manifested itself as the policymakers' response to the financial crisis, that being Dodd-Frank. There's very little in Dodd-Frank that is accounting or auditing related. I mean, a tiny, tiny little sliver and very little interaction between the accounting and auditing provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley and the response to the financial crisis in Dodd-Frank. That's not to say that there aren't lessons to be learned. I think any time we go through as severe a shock as the financial crisis, all participants in the capital markets have to kind of look introspectively and learn the lessons of that era and what we can do better. And certainly there's a renewed emphasis on disclosure, kind of forward-looking information, highlighting risks. You see some of that manifest itself in the recently issued risk assessment standards by the PCAOB, which place a very significant emphasis on the auditor looking at the quality and accuracy of a company's disclosures. But I do believe we're dealing with a very different phenomenon this time around.
Yeah, Alan, do you have anything to add about that?
No, I completely agree with that. I think the one common accounting thread I think of between the two crises, which is otherwise very different, is I think in both cases, and this is not an auditing question, this is a financial reporting question. In both cases, the financial reporting model is inadequate as to how you keep track of things that aren't on the balance sheet.
Interesting.
And other than that, it's not an accounting crisis.
Well, Alan, let me stick with you just for another question here. You know, one of the things that came up and was a big issue right when SOX first came out was whether if there's going to now be an internal control audit over financial reporting. So here again, I'm focusing in on 404. Is it a good idea to have separate firms do the financial statement audit, another firm do the internal control audit? And ultimately what emerged was, no, that's not the way we're going to go. Let's actually mandate that one and the same firm does both. And we could have gone down a different path. So can you give me some perspective on whether the path that was selected was the right path, or would this have been another thing where the market could have figured this out on their own?
I suppose the market could have come out the other way. I've always thought that the way this came out was the right way. And the reason I say that is I think the trouble with the way 404 was initially designed is that it didn't sufficiently integrate the two audits, and therefore you didn't having good controls in and of themselves is a sterile objective. Who cares? One wants good controls because one wants good financial reporting. And obviously the better the controls, I think, the better the chances of good financial reporting. But to follow that premise, you want the two exercises to proceed in lockstep because, in fact, that's the way that you're most likely to have the controls audit inform what happens with the financial statement audit. And I think the other way, you kind of lose that benefit.
This is an issue I have a pretty strong perspective on. Most of the people who know me would say I'm pretty balanced. I generally understand both sides of an issue. On this one, though, I would fail to understand how we would actually improve quality by trying to separate what is essentially become inseparable. The audit itself has become so integrated that I couldn't tell you how much of the audit effort was the internal control audit and how much of the audit was the financial statement audit. The very design of the auditing standards, and appropriately so, is to start by understanding where could there actually be a risk of material misstatement in the financial statements, and then to determine what controls a company has in place to mitigate that risk, then test the effectiveness of those controls, and take what you learn from testing the effectiveness of those controls and use it in actually designing the tests of the underlying numbers, the so-called substantive tests. It's a process that flows seamlessly.
Well, let me, in the last few minutes we have today, Alan and Joe, not that you're necessarily holding yourselves out to be great prognosticators, but what would you say we should be thinking of in terms of the next major regulatory intervention in the auditing profession? Alan?
Well, I think the PCAOB has put us on notice of two that they're thinking about very seriously. One is mandatory auditor rotation. The reaction to that has been certainly on both the preparer and the auditor side uniformly negative and strongly negative. Investors believe that would promote skepticism and independence and a lack of capture in ways that could be helpful. My own view is that will not come to pass in exactly that fashion, but there's going to be more struggle about it. You may end up with a periodic – the audit committee has to, in effect, go out and look every X years as to whether they should change auditors.
So tender. How about, Joe, anything that comes to your mind, the auditor's reporting model or otherwise?
I would focus on kind of the underlying issue that policymakers are trying to solve for versus the prescription, okay. And that is kind of an ever – vigilant effort to ensure the auditors are acting independently, objectively, and skeptically, and challenging management. Okay? And there's different ideas as to how you do that. I would predict that we will continue to see regimes put in place to reinforce and continue to strengthen what was started with Sarbanes-Oxley, which was to power up a very strong, independent, effective audit committee to then set the tone for and oversee a rigorous, independent audit function. And you can dream up, you know, 1,000 different things you think might contribute to that objective, but that's the objective that we all share.
Well, thank you so much, Alan and Joe, for your informed discussion, taking us back to the inception of Sarbanes-Oxley and at the end of the day, looking ahead. Today's program will be an important addition to the collection materials on the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in the museum. I would encourage you to watch the July 30th broadcast on the 10th anniversary of the Act with Senator Sarbanes and Representative Oxley. You may also want to plan to watch the upcoming November 15th, a measured response broadcast looking at the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley as a case study of public outrage inspiring financial regulation. This broadcast will soon be available on audio MP3 format in the museum. An edited transcript will be added later. I invite you to return on Wednesday, November 7th, for the next Deloitte Fireside Chat looking at international convergence. Professor James McKinney of the University of Maryland will be the moderator. The presenters will be Robert Hertz, former chairman of FASB and retired senior partner at PwC LLP, and Joe Yugazuglo. The live broadcast will take place at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, free and accessible worldwide. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Deloitte LLP for its generous support and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining with us today. Good afternoon.